I'm Stuart Nullman. This is number 0378, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0378. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Blythe Ward, author of Stepping Up to a Happy Step Family. It can be a difficult process on many fronts, including discipline.
When you marry someone with children, or you take your family with children and marry someone else with children, there isn't the same type of trust and bonding for the step parent that would be with the biological parent. And so disciplining someone else's children is considered more of a conditional love issue. And the children know that the step parent doesn't love them yet. And so disciplining them, it becomes very difficult for the child and for the parent. There's a lot of pushback.
Dr. Frieda Birnbaum talks about why Facebook friends aren't real friends.
Here's the difference, and here's the problem. You know, when you see someone and you watch their face and you watch their reaction, there's a certain connection, there's a certain message that you get that you just don't get from some kind of picture, some kind of video. There isn't that face connection anymore, and that's what we're really missing.
Vince Fernandez is the author of the murder thriller Little Sister. It features the chilling thought of a remote control medical murder.
The book started because it's based on two things that always scared me. One is the use of wireless technology in medical devices. I was visiting various medical companies back in the 90s, and they were just starting to introduce wireless elements to what they had, whether it be a blood glucose monitor, things that diabetics use to measure their insulin levels, and they would communicate with their doctors, which was a really great thing. The bad side is some of this stuff gets intercepted. The financial part that always scared me is that you can actually own somebody else's life insurance.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0378, is someone who is actually regularly on this program. Stuart Nullman, the host of Book Banter, who is on this show every couple of weeks. He is the guest Slater this time around of the Stuff File program. And thank you very much, Stuart, for doing the guest slate here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. By the way, you can also read Stuart's stuff in the Montreal Times. Check it out. You'll find the link on the What's On page for this week, which is what Stuart just mentioned, 0378. See how it always comes around full circle? And again, thank you very much, Stu, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the program. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And we start off with the Darwin file, because as you know, the tree of life is always and often self-pruning. A young couple having sex in a car inside a garage reportedly made the deadly mistake of turning on the ignition to keep warm. The pair died from carbon monoxide poisoning, according to Russian media. Relatives found them naked and locked in each other's arms in the garage of the man's parents. Russian media reportedly identified the couple as 18-year-old Artem S. and 20-year-old Anna D. of Ufa in southern central Russia. Police say they believe the pair wanted to turn the heat on as temperatures dipped below freezing. Family members say Artem and Anna claim they were going out for a walk but wound up in his car. The two had been dating for just a few months. He'd just graduated from catering college and wanted to open an auto body shop. Gee, I'm guessing they teach drastically different things in catering colleges in Russia. And, you know, not to be a buzzkill here, but when it's freezing out and you're in a car, is it really necessary to get completely naked to have sex? Well, at least they went out with a bang. 25-year-old Jamie Thompson held police at bay for 7 hours in his flat at Kilburnie, North Ayrshire, which is in Scotland. He had a number of large knives on his windowsill and threw at least one of them at officers. "I'll chop your heads off," he taunted. "Bring it on. I will kill you." During the standoff, Thompson, who was drunk, pelted the cops with fireworks, shards of glass, cans, bottles, crockery, ice cream tubs, and a game console, and shot at them with a crossbow. A police marksman finally ended the siege by shooting Thompson, wounding him in the arm. Thompson was apparently so satisfied with how police ended the confrontation, he said he'd like to write a letter in favor of the police marksman. He pleaded guilty to attempted murder and was sentenced to 9 years in prison, which may or may not result in a letter in favor of the judge. And Lord knows, he'll have plenty of time to write that letter. At least he's a somewhat polite young man. You know, never underestimate the power of a well-written thank you note. Well, a man went to a cell phone shop in Gainesville, Florida, and demanded that they fix his phone. Their response was perhaps unwise. They told him to wait until the store opened. The enraged man went to his car and got a gun and threatened to shoot if he didn't get the help that he wanted right now. Police arrived to find him in his car armed with a shotgun and a revolver. 59-year-old Wayne Cannon was charged with aggravated assault and weapons violations and threatened to kill the police once he is out of jail. He was held on $200,000 bond. Well, at the jail, he is entitled to his one call, but he need not worry. I believe they have working phones there. And a man in Nagani Township, Michigan, was awakened by noises at his front door. He went to investigate and saw a man inside the house's entryway. The homeowner yelled and the intruder fled. Michigan State Police troopers located the suspect, who ran into the woods. Officers gave chase and eventually located the man, lying on the ground, unconscious. He had run into a tree and knocked himself out. The suspect, 21-year-old Jacob Romer, was arrested and charged with home invasion and assaulting, resisting, obstructing a police officer. Okay, aren't they piling on here just a little bit? I mean, assaulting, resisting, and obstructing a police officer? Really? You realize the guy was apprehended by a tree, right? Yeah. Anyway, we have time for one more story here in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Prominent British radio host Dame Jenny Murray suggested in October that the UK scrap traditional sex education courses in school and instead show pornographic videos for classes to analyze in the exact same way as they analyzed Jane Austen in order to encourage discussion of the role of sex. Now, younger students may explore why a boy should not look up a girl's skirt, but older students would view hardcore material to confront, for example, whether normal women should shave or make the typical screeching moans that porno actresses make. Dame Jenny said simply condemning pornography is naive because too much money is at stake. I wonder how her financial portfolio is structured. Also, under her concept, there would be no shortage of homework material available. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Blythe Ward is the author of Stepping Up to a Happy Step Family. It's a book that delves into the challenges that stepfamilies face with managing an instant family. Blythe joins us on the line right now from Toronto. Hi, Blythe.
Hello there.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So I guess you're basically about to bust the myth that we've learned from the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, that's for sure. Absolutely. I mean, because they started everybody thinking that it was all going to be so much fun and so easy. And, you know, it can be fun and it can be not always difficult, but it's not the Brady Bunch, no.
Are the problems compounded by the way previous relationships ended? And by that I mean, Is it a different situation when you marry into a family that is of divorce as opposed to marrying into a family where there's a widow or widower?
You know, they are different, but they are the same in many ways. The issue with death is that you don't have that extra person. You don't have the ex-spouse that you have to accommodate or worry about in that regard. But you have children and often a parent, too, that is still grieving and will grieve because, as we know, when you lose someone you really love, you never, ever get over that. You just learn to accept it and move on in your life. So there are compounds, yes. To both those issues when you remarry.
Well, the reason why I bring it up is because I'm assuming in a lot of cases that when someone loses a parent, literally loses a parent as in death, that mm-hmm. person might be open to having a mother figure or father figure in their life that they have just lost.
Yes. Depending on the age of the children, yes.
Right.
If they're young, there's a good possibility for that. But children don't forget that they have another mother and that the mother's not there, or they have another father, but they're gone now. And so they still want to celebrate that person's life. They still want to think of them as their father. So it depends on the family, really, whether they want to decide that they want the step-parent to be a mother or a father figure.
Now, children are often like water. They will travel the path of least resistance, and a child will quickly learn, even in a nuclear family with their own mother and father, who is the difficult or more demanding disciplinarian, and they will learn very early how to divide and conquer. It must be complicated when one of those parents isn't actually their natural parent, because that's another layer there, isn't there?
Yes, it is, definitely. When you marry someone with children, or you take your family with children and marry someone else with children, there isn't the same type of trust and bonding for the step-parent that would be with the biological parent. And so disciplining someone else's children is considered more of a conditional love issue. And the children know that the step-parent doesn't love them yet, and so disciplining them, it becomes very difficult for the child and for the parent. There's a lot of pushback with both the parents. So, yes, there's issues with discipline that you might not have in a nuclear type of family.
Now, can it be complicated, especially if the children are... When I say young, I'm saying over 5, but say less than 10, somewhere in that age range. Does it complicate the matter for said children if the parents now have another child? In other words, the parents now have a biological child that is of both of the parents as opposed to just one of the parents. Does that cause any sibling rivalries that might develop because a child either feels that one parent is trying to replace them with a child of their own, or that they're going to be unloved, or whatever the case may be?
Well, a new baby in the family always affects the family. Doesn't matter which family it is. But at first, it's very difficult for children, unless the parents are very careful, that they reinforce to the child that they love them very much and that this child is not going to get in the way. Give them responsibilities with the child, make them part of it, bring them to the hospital right away, make them part of the whole situation. That's helpful. But it's also how the parents deal with it after the child is born, too, remembering that babies can be very loving and caring with all children. They don't care if you're a step-sister or brother or not. They love everybody, and they put their little hands out and grab the fingers, no matter which finger it is. So it doesn't take too long for children to fall in love with a baby, and often it can unite a family as well, if the parents are careful to always include the other children too.
Now, this is something you've had a lot of experience in. You are a stepmother. You're also a therapist. You're a researcher.
Yes.
So you've written this book, Stepping Up to a Happy Step Family. You've obviously experienced a lot of this, and being a therapist, you have some understanding of all this. But what made you feel that this book needed to be written? Are you hearing a lot of stories from people saying, I just don't know what to do, or I don't know how to handle this situation, or did you feel there wasn't enough out there being written on this subject?
I think both. When I was counseling, I had a lot of stepfamilies in my office, and they all really wanted to make their marriage work. They wanted to make the family work, and they were trying really hard. And I decided to retire. So when I retired, I wondered where a lot of these stepfamilies were going to go for counseling, because I had a basic understanding of it being in a stepfamily myself, and over the years, with all the experience I had with my clients. So I decided that I would write a book and put down some of the ideas to help people so that they could see that it could be a positive thing, that remarriage is another chance. It's a second chance. And I think that a lot of the literature that was out there was very negative about it. This is the problem, and good luck, basically. So I wanted to write my book in a positive way that gave people hope that they could remarry, and they could remarry with children in it and learn to be happy and, you know, grow to find their strong friendships between the children, and that there is happiness there,
not just difficulty. Are some people afraid to remarry because they're afraid that they will have step-parenting issues?
Yes, and they will. They will. But that's not to be afraid of. It's to face and to look at. And my book gives you lots of heads-up ideas on what to do when certain things happen. And that gives you confidence to deal with the issues. I think a lot of it is that people think they're going to have another family just like the first family feeling. And they're not. They're not going to have that because there's going to be two families in one house. And so once you understand that and accept that, then the struggle isn't so hard.
Not to generalize, but in terms of when you're doing this research and also in therapy, have you found one side more than the other, more concerned about how the blended family works? And by that I mean, who seems to be more concerned? The step-parent trying to work his or her way into the family, or the natural parent who's concerned about bringing someone in harmoniously into the family?
Probably the parent with the children is concerned because they are worried that they will be able to deal with all the issues that are going to come up. For example, finances. How are you going to deal with that? And discipline. How are you going to deal with that? And remember that in a marriage, usually people get to know each other, and then they have children. And in this circumstance, they get to know each other well. They're getting to know the children well. They're moving forward in the family. So it's a process, and it takes time. And I think step-parents need to know that they have to go slowly, and that in the end, it's going to work out, but they need to take their time and not try to force it.
And that greater concern you just described from the parent's point of view, does that differ greatly between whether the fact the parent is the father or the mother?
No, not usually, except that mothers are very trained, so to speak, from birth often to nurture and love and care about children. And maybe more so than men, but although that's changing in this day and age now. And fathers have become very good parents as well and very involved parents as well. But I think that mothers might feel the pressure more because society also expects mothers to step up and be good at everything and to be able to understand what all the issues are for these children. So maybe stepmoms more so.
It's an interesting topic indeed, and this book sounds like one that's a long time in coming for many people who are in this blended family situation, because let's face it, 50% of marriages end in divorce, so there's the chances of this happening are great. The book is called Stepping Up to a Happy Step Family, written by Blythe Ward. Blythe, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It was interesting to talk with you.
Blythe Ward, author of Stepping Up to a Happy Step Family. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0378, and you'll find links to her website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll learn about the shocking news, shocking I say, that Facebook friends aren't real friends. Hell surprise. And we'll meet the author of Little Sister, a murder mystery that deals with a remote control medical murder. Ooh. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, the Drug Enforcement Administration won't identify an undercover informant that has worked for them in South Florida for 31 years, but admit that in that time they have paid him about $1.5 million, an average of more than $48,000 per year. The information came out in a court hearing about the same time the findings of an audit by the Department of Justice's Office of the Inspector General was released, which notes that over a 5-year span, the DEA paid $237 million to 9,000 confidential sources nationwide. The audit found the DEA did not adequately oversee payments to its sources, which exposes the DEA to an unacceptably increased potential for fraud, waste, and abuse. Informants are sometimes paid as much as 25% of the cash or the value of the drug seized and work under written contracts. A DEA spokeswoman notes that informants are well paid, but you never know what the informant is going through or the dangers they face, the risks they are taking on. The judge in the case, where the informant's long career came out, U.S. Magistrate Judge William Matthewman, who was previously a police officer in Miami, commented, "It's surprising that he's still alive." Well, in South Florida at least, it appears that crime does pay, and it pays very well. But do they have medical and an adequate retirement package? That's what I want to know. Melvin Court was in his 90s and wasn't in great health. Nevertheless, when his daughters went to his home and found his body, they went into a panic. They put him in a shallow grave right on the property, and according to the Lake County, Florida Sheriff's Office, they told their uncle that he had moved. But after 9 years went by with no contact with his brother, the uncle reported Court missing. Also, an anonymous tipster said there was a grave on the property. Remains were dug up from the grave, identification is pending, and the daughters may face charges of improperly disposing of human remains. Okay, just how close were these brothers? I mean, I don't think it would take me 9 years to report one of my siblings missing. Seriously. Anyway, here's the latest clown sighting for you. Numerous people called 911 in the community of Cunningham in Montgomery County, Tennessee, to report a white female wearing clown-like makeup chasing cars in the road while in various stages of undress. Before the sheriff's deputy arrived, the woman herself called 911 four times, in which call takers were berated, threatened, and cursed. The deputy found 37-year-old Candace A. Crydell clad in a sports bra, pajama bottoms, a stocking cap, and a considerable amount of paint of makeup about her body and face that could easily be described as clown-like. She was also holding a beer, and the deputies found empty beer cans, a clown wig, and a mask. Crydell was arrested on charges of disorderly conduct, public intoxication, and misuse of 911. Well, she didn't need the wig and makeup to convince anyone she was a clown. I mean, if you want to be a clown, apparently all you have to do is add copious amounts of alcohol. An off-duty officer moonlighting as a security guard at a car dealership in Sugarland, Texas, heard someone inside. No one was supposed to be there as the dealership was closed on Sunday. He investigated and found a man inside near the finance office carrying a crowbar. When the officer confronted the man, he dropped the crowbar and ran and escaped in a waiting car. In addition to the crowbar, the man left behind a backpack. It contained pry bars, gloves, a mallet, bolt cutters, cutting blades, and his math homework. Well now, he will have a new neat update for his excuse to the teacher. Yes, the police dog ate my work. He can always get his GED in prison. Anyway, finally in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 29-year-old Kanna Greer was arrested in Sacramento, California in October when police responded to a call to help her remove handcuffs that she had accidentally engaged while fooling around with a friend. Yes. Police, routinely checking her ID, discovered an outstanding felony burglary warrant. As per procedure, officers took her to a fire station for removal of the cuffs to make room on her wrists for their own handcuffs. Yeah. Word of advice to people getting frisky with handcuffs and things going wrong: eliminate the middleman. Go directly to the fire department yourself. That might be the best plan of action. Yeah. Or maybe a hardware store. Or a locksmith. Anyway. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Facebook has turned the word friend into a verb. But just because you friended someone on Facebook doesn't mean they are really your friends. That's the riveting fact from a study that found almost all Facebook friends are entirely fake. Back on the program with us is Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, a research psychologist, psychoanalyst, and author of Life Begins at 60, A New View on Motherhood, Marriage, and Reinventing Ourselves. She joins us on the line right now from New Jersey. Hi, Dr. Frieda.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure.
The reason why I said in the introduction riveting is because I was being rather sarcastic. I find it hard to believe that anyone who hasn't grown up in the Facebook world, and that's all they know from whatever age they are, and in other words, anyone who is older, I can't believe that they would believe Facebook friends are all real.
You know, we live in a time where people are actually living through technology, Facebook, texting, cell phones, gaming, you name it. So they're used to this kind of interaction, which is not so great.
I remember back when Facebook started, actually, go back a little further, when CompuServe was still around. And one of the things I found very interesting at the time, again, talking about it from a psychological point of view, is that people believe the reason why such forums at the time were becoming popular was because as human beings, we needed a so-called gathering place. People either went to church or social halls or sat on a particular stoop in the neighborhood, and that's where people gathered. And we weren't doing that anymore, so now we are doing it electronically. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a very fair assessment. It's very interesting, but here's the difference and here's the problem. You know, when you see someone and you watch their face and you watch their reaction, there's a certain connection, there's a certain message that you get that you just don't get from some kind of picture, some kind of video. There isn't that face connection anymore, and that's what we're really missing.
Do you find that people are taking this way too seriously? Or let me rephrase that question. Are you surprised by how seriously some people are taking this?
Yes, because they spend so much time in their days just searching what other people are doing, their social arenas, their birthdays, messaging them back. It's a lot of time. But here's the thing. You can have hundreds, you can have thousands of Facebook friends, but who are your real friends? We break them down, or research has shown 15 friends, and maybe 5 really good friends. Because, you know, how many people can you have in your life anyway? We don't even have that kind of time. I mean, I get people wishing me a happy birthday, or I get people saying, you know, I get messages, it's their birthday, and I'm wondering, do I really know them? And most of the time, I don't really know them that well. So we're confused about what friendship really means. And it's somebody who you can share your problems with, and you don't want to put that all over social media. No. Somebody who can have empathy and camaraderie with, have activities, go places with. That's what friends are about. You can't get that same kind of maintenance, that same kind of standard on the screen.
It's interesting you say that, because one of the things I'm seeing a lot more of on Facebook these days, besides, of course, with this election year that you're having in the United States, there's a lot of vitriol going back and forth over that. That's another issue on its own. But another thing I'm seeing a lot of is people who, and again, you don't really know them, people who seem to be reaching out for help with every little negative thing that goes on in their lives.
And that's a real turnoff. Those people are not going to be supported in the same way. And it's not possible, because you just are not going to be a social worker for someone else's problems. So friendships are based on problems and understanding and caring. But you can't possibly really know what's going on when you're just looking at some messages out there. So, you know, we're missing that aspect of what it is to have a complete picture. I mean, my son, you know, who does gaming, doesn't want his friends over because they can game, they can do these things if they're not in the same house. So it doesn't even induce feelings of having people over, because we've gone into such a place where everything, the blogging, Twitter, all this is what people are constantly looking up. It's taking a lot of time. I mean, one thing that Facebook does do for you is when you have a friendship that you just don't have time for, and so it prevents it from completely decaying. You have some kind of connection. So there's something going on. Other than that, the depth of it all sometimes creates jealousy, seeing other people having a good time, going places, and you're wondering why you're not doing it. But, you know, that's a false facade, because people take pictures at those moments in time. Doesn't mean that this is the life that they're necessarily living all the time either. So there's a lot that's going on that's changed the way we look at relationships through Facebook, because you can have acquaintances, you can have partners, you can have different types of relationships at work, different levels of intimacy with different kinds of people. So there's all kinds of different kinds of friendships that we do have in our lives.
Now, you talk about the idea of it not being real, and you know, I'm on Facebook. I have a lot of friends on Facebook, but part of it is the fact that I'm a public figure, and when I use Facebook, which is constantly, I don't take it seriously. I don't get into heavy discussions. I make jokes, for instance, about the current political situation in the United States, but I'm not making a serious choice as to a side or an issue. I'm just having fun on Facebook. So a little while ago, back in May, I reached the limit that you're allowed to have on Facebook. So I said, as a joke, I put on a post, and the post was, "As I hover dangerously close to the maximum amount of friends allowed on Facebook, it is time to do some heavy pruning. Assuming some of you won't get past the swimsuit and talent portions of this process, this might be the last message you see from me." Now, a lot of people got the joke. Some people were outraged. Absolutely outraged. And I'm going, why? And of course, by the way, the ones who were outraged were the ones I pruned. But
you're funny. I mean, you're funny. But that's interesting, though, because people want to gather as many friends or supposedly friends as they can. It gives them a status. How many friendships, how many people are trying to become their friends? Some people don't discriminate at all. They just get everybody on board. So that's refreshing what you're saying. And I know it was a joke, but there's a statement underneath that, too, that, you know, I want to be selective. I want to be choosy. I want the people that are contacting me to be supportive of who I am as well. So that's interesting, because we're not doing that anymore. We're just bringing as many people, anybody on. You have to be careful also who you have on your Facebook. How much do you want to reveal? Do you know that people who are hiring people actually look them up on their Facebook? So if you're having a party and you're drinking too much, that could work against you from getting another job.
Mm. Now, you brought up something about gaming and your son, and I wanted to, we just have a few minutes, I want to delve into that a little bit, because you say your son doesn't even want his friends coming over anymore because he can play online with them. As bad as you say that might be, these are at least friends, I'm assuming, that he has at some point a personal connection with and he knows who they are. I'd be more concerned if he was getting rid of his friends to play against people he doesn't know.
That's true, too, because these games can be extremely isolating. So in one way, yes, to have people to talk to, and then the other way is what you're mentioning, not to know who you're talking to, that could be problematic as well. So there is a danger zone that we're talking about, where kids could put themselves in the harm's way of someone who is really not there for them, or get so comfortable not relating to people because they just are into these gadgets and these computers. They're texting instead of calling. They won't even talk on the phone anymore because it's easier to text. So we're getting more and more away from the essential natural part of having communities around us, because that's what really gives us life. And, you know, they say you live longer when you have friends and you're around people. And this new generation, I hate to say it, their longevity is at stake because they're spending too much time online.
That's a very valid point, and we'll end it on that. Dr. Frieda, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Again, your book, your latest book, A Life Begins at 60, A New View on Motherhood, Marriage, and Reinventing Ourselves. I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, author of Life Begins at 60, A New View on Motherhood, Marriage, and Reinventing Ourselves. You can check out her website at drfrieda.com, and doctor is spelled out, that's D-O-C-T-O-R, drfrieda.com. And of course, you'll find the link on my website at thestufffile.com. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Over the years, we've talked about many reasons for not filing a lawsuit. They can be expensive and time-consuming, of course, but did you know that one reason actually has a special name featured on Wikipedia? It's called the Streisand Effect. The name comes from a lawsuit filed by entertainer Barbara Streisand. Here's the story. Several years ago, she sued a photographer for $50 million. Why? The photographer had taken a picture of her home, and thousands of others, as part of a government effort to document erosion of the California coastline. She didn't want her house appearing in any photos, though, so she sued. Before her lawsuit, only 6 people had downloaded the picture from the internet. But after she sued, more than 400,000 people visited the website and then saw her home. Let's be fair, making a mountain out of a molehill by filing a lawsuit can backfire in many ways. Find out more about the hidden costs of lawsuit abuse. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses. But recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the comic book. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about a remote control murder. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And we have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now, on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, in September, the world's first legal beer pipeline opened, pumping 12,000 bottles worth an hour from the Halve Man Brewery in Bruges, Belgium, to its bottling plant, which is only 2 miles away, and thus sparing visitors to the historic city the sight of tanker trucks cluttering the cobblestone streets. The pipeline was partly funded by private citizens, offered free beer for life for their donations. Just how long is a life when you're getting beer for free is another question, but I'm sure it's not one they're overly concerned with. And security experts hired by the investment firm Muddy Waters, which is being sued for defamation by St. Jude Medical Incorporated over claims that St. Jude's cardiac implant device can be hacked, disclosed in an October court filing that they agree the devices are anonymously and maliciously hackable. They found that a popular control device called Merlin at Home could be remotely turned off or jiggered to carry a dangerous electrical charge from up to 100 feet away. A similar incident was part of a plot in season 2 of the Homeland TV series as the means by which the ailing U.S. vice president was assassinated. Gee. And before, the biggest thing these patients had to concern themselves with was garage door openers and microwave ovens. Does a story like this scare you enough? Well, then perhaps you should sit down for our final guest tonight, who is up right now. Vince Fernandez has been in the financial field for more than 20 years, but he's ventured onto the literary side to write a novel called Little Sister. It's a thriller that takes you into the possible world of remote control murder. Vince joins us on the line right now from New York City. Hi, Vince.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So you, as I said, are in the financial field, but you've written this thriller, although there is a financial aspect to it, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about the book.
Sure. The book started because it's based on two things that always scared me. One is the use of wireless technology in medical devices. I was visiting various medical companies back in the 90s, and they were just starting to introduce wireless elements to what they had, whether it be a blood glucose monitor, things that diabetics use to measure their insulin levels, implantable defibrillators. things for your heart. And they would communicate with their doctors, which was a really great thing. The bad side is some of this stuff gets intercepted. And occasionally, when they're getting updated, people can play around a little bit with the devices. So pretty frightening stuff. The financial part that always scared me is that you can actually own somebody else's life insurance. It's called a life settlement. It's been around since the 1980s or so. And it started with mostly guys and some gals who had AIDS. And as they were trying to treat themselves, they blew through all their money, and the insurance companies weren't willing to fund them. The last asset that they had was something they could never use, which was their life insurance. So if I were to have AIDS, let's pretend I do, and we're back in the 80s when there wasn't any treatment, I would come to you, Peter, and say, Peter, I have a $1 million policy. Give me $500,000 for it today, and when I die, you get the $1 million. So it kind of changes the tone a little bit when we meet on the street a few weeks later, and you come up to me and Vince and say, Vince, how are you feeling today? Are you asking me how I'm really doing and coping with my disease, or are you thinking, well, when do I finally get my cash? So I put the two together. And sort of a wicked hedge fund manager who, as all his tricks are taken away, starts buying up these life settlements and seeing if he can hack into them, into the devices that the people have.
It's a fascinating idea for a story, but as I said in the introduction, you're a guy in the financial field. Have you been somebody who's always written, or is this something that a story that just had to get out as far as you were concerned?
Well, I wrote a fair bit when I was younger, but I didn't write for about 20 years. Sort of caught up in both my career in the financial world as well as raising a family. But this really needed to get out of me. It's one of these things where kind of a little bit of reflection on both what's going on in the industry and people around me. So there's no one nearly as bad as the bad guy in this book. There's best described that all his characteristics are like little pieces of Lego from various people that I've met over time, but kind of spread out on the table. In the antagonist, his name is John Lister, I kind of stack them all up on top of each other. So it is a bit of a reflection of some of the less than great people you meet in the industry over time. There's a lot of wonderful people, but it's, you know, wonderful people are not often very interesting to write about, particularly in the setting of a financial thriller.
Well, that brings up another question. I mean, again, with your financial background, I'm sure friends and family were aware of the fact that you were writing this book. Now that it is out, now that it's a fictionalized story, a novel that deals with murder, is anybody who knows you and knows the people around you, are they trying to figure out if they can sense who you're writing about, or does somebody think you're writing about them?
No. None of the characters are based on people I actually know, of course. But that has come up, so people have been guessing a little bit. But I can assure them that nobody in the book is actually somebody that I know. But, you know, over time, just as almost any sort of novelist, you base it on some snippets here and there of characteristics of either situations where there was a lot of stress or sort of people that just in some of their very basic ways that you can sort of understand them a little bit and see what would drive somebody to do something. Again, I don't know anyone who's gone as far as my antagonist, John Lister, but it's sort of fun to think about what you could do if you kind of lose touch with reality.
You have a busy career. You have a family life, as you've mentioned. What was the process like for you to carve out a little time to write this?
Well, this is, I wrote this mostly on my iPhone. I had about a 45-minute commute to work and back again in the evenings, and I would sit on the streetcar in Toronto and write away. And I've never became really good at Candy Crush or any other of those video games that are on your iPhone, and I had a bit more fun doing that. The real genesis of the book actually happened because we were doing a renovation on our house, and we were replacing our kitchen, and our TV died at the same time, and my wife and I decided it'd be much nicer to have a really big stove than have a really big TV. And so we actually didn't have a TV for about 4 years. And amazing how much productivity it gets when one is not watching and actually doing something.
Wow, if I was out without TV for 4 years, I'd have to call The Hague.
Well, I would, you know, I'd still watch sports. I'd go down to the local bar and things like that, and we watch things on Netflix and the like. But it was nice that it was much more purposeful in terms of what we were trying to do as we would sit down in the evenings. And I wrote a lot of it actually once the kids went to bed, and my wife was busy with her own business as well. So it you can find, it's actually interesting. There is time. Most people say, like, I don't have the time. Well, if you think about the amount of time you actually spend playing video games on your phone while you're commuting, those that have the luxury of being in a train or something like that rather than driving, there's actually a lot of time there. So I'm actually probably the only person who complains about a shorter commute. We moved to a location just a little bit further outside of Toronto, but I have a direct train to downtown now. Instead of having 45 minutes, I have 23 minutes on the train, and I'm just not as productive as I'd like to be.
Well, with again, with the writing process for you, as you were, I'm sure you had an idea for this story, as you said, in your head as to what it was going to be, but did you flesh it out as you wrote? In other words, did you know a beginning, middle, and an end of the story before you started writing it, or did you learn the story as you went along?
Well, I knew the beginning and I knew the end, and I wasn't quite sure where the middle was going. And for me, the way that I like to write is not to know that and allow the characters and their interaction that kind of come up along the way to kind of flesh things out and to flesh the emotions out. The first draft that I did was probably about 50, maybe almost 100% longer than where the book ended up. So there's a lot that it kind of ended up on the cutting room floor, so to speak. But that was okay because I needed that part to really understand my characters. Some people write by writing out full outlines with extremely detailed character development. Frankly, I don't work that way. And I found it much easier for this book and the subsequent ones that I'm writing right now to kind of let things flow and spend time with my characters and let them evolve and not necessarily hold them to be, in a way, terribly consistent. And I know that sounds a bit odd, but no one's really consistent in their lives, right? We've all done things that we like to think we live life one way. We've done things along the way that aren't quite right. You got upset at a situation or you turn left when you normally turn right. And it's sort of fun to, you haven't changed as a person, but there's like little bits along the way that kind of deviate. And I find that by kind of writing a bit more stream-like rather than with a very rigid outline, that allows me to explore that sort of humanity within the characters, that those faults.
There is a very popular genre in novel writing these days, especially in thrillers, of people who were not initially writers but come from different backgrounds and who write thrillers that are based on the background they come from. Many doctors are thriller writers. Coroners are thriller writers. Financial advisors are thriller writers. Is this something that you want to do more of, especially now that your first novel, Little Sister, is out?
Well, I'm enjoying it. I have two more on the go right now. The second one is best described as a companion to the first one. My antagonist and the protagonist show up again, but the book actually happens at the same time as the first book. It's not stuff that would have been appropriate in the first book because the lead character is a different person, but these two other characters are still kind of playing all in the same field, and so they kind of come along. I have a second book, which is actually based on an unbelievable story I heard on a streetcar one day, and just a wonderfully tragic story of a young woman who didn't know she had a father and finds out that she has a dad. And I won't go into more than that, but it was unbelievably poignant listening to her as she's talking to her friend. So I hear a lot of, it's actually quite interesting taking your earbuds out and listening to the world around you. There's some amazing stories going on, some very funny ones and some very tragic ones.
I was about to say, either you get a lot done or learn a lot when you're on that streetcar. It's amazing what you've managed to do.
There's an amazing amount of humanity. And actually, one of the things that's quite interesting, I used to live in downtown Toronto, where the subways and streetcars are made up of a very broad mix of people taking them, both from age groups, ethnicities, income backgrounds, and the stories were really rich and true. I now live more in the suburbs, we're out there for a few years, and it's actually a much more homogeneous group. And this group actually doesn't talk very much in public, and it's a very, very silent ride. So it allows me a bit more time to work on the novel as opposed to listening for things to put into the novel. Well, it's still fun getting on the subway and listening to people.
It's a very interesting and different topic for a story. The novel is called Little Sisters, written by Vince Fernandez. Vince, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Vince Fernandez, author of Little Sister. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0378, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Two men in New Jersey were arrested after taking a taxi to rob a home and refusing to pay their driver. 46-year-old Kenneth Burke and 38-year-old Timothy Foote took a taxi from a neighborhood in Deal Township and asked the driver to wait outside as they entered a home. The two later emerged from the home with a television and several liquor bottles and rode the cab back to an apartment in Ashbury Park. Upon their arrival, Burke and Foote left the taxi without paying their fare, prompting the driver to call Ashbury Park Police. Ashbury Park Police contacted police in Deal, who determined the house had been burgled and returned the stolen items. Burke and Foote were taken to Monmouth County Correctional Institution and charged with burglary, conspiracy to commit burglary, criminal trespass, and theft. Now why? Oh why? Would you stiff a cab driver after you've just committed a robbery, especially when it's a round trip so the cabbie knows your destination and point of origin? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0378. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0378. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes. Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.